Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Shea, where we answer your questions, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live, where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archives from past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Shea.
Well, happy concussive Sundays.
Yeah. Happy concussive Sunday. Yeah, absolutely. So, I got a concussion on Thursday afternoon. Greg, I'm hearing feedback. I don't know if everybody else is, too. And of course, the moment I mention it, it's gone. Anyway, so
because I muted.
No,
is
it's still there. It's
what
still
the
there.
What the hell? Hold on.
Yeah, we're having a bit of technical problems. I had a massive static in my microphone this morning. Shall I keep talking?
I don't know. Is it still there?
No, that sounds better. But we'll see.
What the hell?
Yeah. Okay. Bye. That sounds all right. Sometimes Skype, right? So I fell off Phantom on Thursday and really whacked my head. I mean, I rung my bell. I lost consciousness for about 15 to 30 seconds and it was really hard to get back. I mean, it was like coming out, you know, some dream, but you find yourself like on your back in the middle of a field and there's stuff going on and you kind of don't know who everybody is and so on. So anyway, so
people standing over you saying, I think that's it. Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, so, and it was just that she jumped, she was scared, and she jumped big, and I went left, and she went right, and so we parted ways. So it wasn't, you know, she wasn't being malicious, she wasn't trying to get me off, she was just like, oh my god, I don't know what I'm doing, so.
Launched. Wow.
Yeah, anyway, so I was definitely woozy that evening, and was having memory problems, and wasn't quite mentally clear, but since then, I've been much, much better, and so I'm feeling basically back to my normal, you know, not quite mentally competent self. So hopefully we'll be all good. Hopefully we'll be all good today.
In the clear.
Yeah. And actually, Greg, why don't you tell us what topics we have on tap?
Oh, yeah. We do have this the show with the questions and stuff. All right. Great set of questions on developing resilience, how apropos, nuisance limits for new technology, spouses sharing activities, and more.
Yeah, so if you're listening live, folks, you can post questions and comments in the text chat over at philosophyinaction.com/live.
Yeah, so beyond the concussion and the recovery and those interesting things, anything else going on?
No, really, actually not.
That kind of occupied your
like
time?
That's been, you know, I've been doing some work, I've been getting some stuff done, but that has definitely, like, that put a full stop to my week. There was nothing else going on. I'm really hoping I can get back on, at least get on Lila on Monday, because she's my safe horse, just on the flat. We won't do any jumping yet. But I am just feeling pretty much totally back to normal. So okay. hoping that'll be good to
They have that saying about getting back in the saddle and everything, so yeah
and I'm not scared at all, in part because it wasn't a scary experience. I don't actually remember, like, I remember her starting the leap, but I don't remember anything after that because it happened so quickly. So like there was no like, oh my god, I'm being run away with, and you know, moments of fear. Nah, you know, it's not there. So anyway, I just, you know, I'm gonna have to be a bit more careful, and the experience has definitely taught me some things. Not that that's how I wanted to learn it, but it was definitely instructive. It put an exclamation point on certain things I've been learning here lately, so that's good news.
Okay, well, if nothing else, let's jump in.
Absolutely. Yeah, we've actually got quite a bit to cover today, so get your thinking caps on, people. We get ready.
It's conga time. Developing resilience. Does developing resilience require enduring hardship? Many people assume that having faced great hardship is a necessary part of having resiliency, meaning the ability to withstand great challenges in the future. These people think that if you have faced less than average hardship in your youth, that makes you soft, spoiled, pampered, and weak, and therefore ill-equipped to face challenges throughout your adulthood. As an extreme but sadly real example, I have a relative who insists to me, quote, All of the men I have met who attended private school are weak and naive. In their private schools, they were able to leave their belongings unattended without fear or of their belongings being stolen. That's not the real world. By contrast, the public school we attended is the school of hard knocks that shows you the real world. We remember all too well that when anyone left possessions unattended, the norm was for the possessions to be stolen. That's real life. That builds character and gave me a thicker skin. That's why when I have children, I will send them to public school to toughen them up. I refuse to raise privileged weaklings, unquote. The questioner continues, I see it and feel tempted to respond, quote, what if you got really drunk and beat up your children? Following the logic of your assumptions, wouldn't that toughen them up even further? Unquote. Why are these assumptions about hardship so prevalent? How can a person develop great discipline, stamina, and fortitude absent hardship and cruelty? What can be done to combat the idea that hardship in youth is necessary for strength and resilience as an adult? Oh,
yeah,
boy.
So I definitely feel the pain about people saying these kinds of things about their kids, and we will get to that. I really agree with the reductio ad absurdum argument given here. Unfortunately, regular people don't seem to understand those, so I can see that not getting you anywhere. What I want to do is really just, apart from the irrationality of this person's view, I want to tackle this question about resilience because I think it's really interesting. So we have three major questions here to answer. One is, what is resilience? Two is resilience a virtue? And three, how should resilience be cultivated? And then after that, we'll get to this issue about how to toughen up your kids, right?
Yeah. All right. So first up, what is resilience?
Yeah, so resilience, just in my dictionary definition, which I think is reasonably accurate, is, quote, the capacity to recover quickly from difficulties, toughness, close quote. And basically, this idea of resilience, this capacity to recover from difficulties, to keep going in the face of difficulties, this is something, it's a quality that's often required for sports and other hobbies. It's required for being a parent or just caring for other people. It's required for writing. I certainly need resilience, at least personally, I really need resilience when I'm writing. And just any other kind of work, though, the going gets tough in anything you might do. And
your career.
Yeah, you need the capacity to keep going. And so basically resilience is going to mean that when you face those obstacles and whatever you're attempting to do, you're going to have the internal resources to achieve what you want to do. And those resources are going to be things like, you know, the determination, like, yes, I'm going to go do this, the mental toughness, the emotional control, the physical capacity, the required skills. And if you lack resilience, you are going to give up oftentimes in sort of disgust and despair, and you might regret afterwards, God, I wish I'd kept going, but, you know, I gave up too soon, et cetera, et cetera. So resilience is definitely a value as a character trait, right? We are going to need this capacity to be resilient in the face of difficulties and opposition and failure. And, I mean, look, like, life is not always easy. You oftentimes need to be able to, like, put that extra push in if you want to achieve, if you want success in life. And that brings us to our second question here.
Right. So is it a virtue?
No. And this is, I think, where it gets a little bit interesting for me as the ethicist. And this is because sometimes resilience is actually the wrong strategy, right? Like, yeah, sometimes you need to man up, right? You need to man up and get the job done. But sometimes you need to do what a friend of mine called boy up, which is where you quit before you go seriously wrong and you're going to start afresh later. And this... This I love this. I was introduced to this phrase at SnowCon, actually, and it was basically the question of, should we go down this more difficult black run or should we do this blue run at the end of the day? And and he said, you know, sometimes you just need to boy up, right? Sometimes you need to decide, look, it's just not worth it to do the harder thing now when I'm already tired and so on, and let's just go down the easier blue run and have a good time and be safe. And I love that because sometimes that really is the right thing to do. So
I'm totally going to use this.
I know, isn't that great? So resilience, basically, it's not a virtue for the same reason that persistence or determination or grit, that those aren't virtues either. Because sometimes you do need to stop. Sometimes you need to let go, right? You've already lost $100 betting at poker. This is not where you need resilience, right? You need to quit and be done for the night. when you are driving, you know, you're trying to get home and you really want to get home that night, but you are just too tired to drive safely. This is not where you need resilience. This is where you need the wisdom to pull off on the side of the road and take a nap. Or, you know, when your ski conditions are degrading and, God, it's, you know, you really can't see and the light is flat and it's gotten icy, this is not the time to be resilient, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, hey, look, your horse is behaving badly. This actually wasn't quite what was happening with me, but, you know, and you're like, God, do I really want to risk this? Or am I just going to get off and walk home and, you know, settle everybody down and try this again later? In those cases, you are better off saving the challenge for another day. You're better off saving it for when conditions are better, meaning, let's say, you're not so tired or external conditions are better and so on. So this, what this is, this means is basically resilience is something you want to do selectively. You don't just want to be resilient all the time. Moreover, resilience isn't always a good quality in a person. It's one of these qualities that makes a good person better and a bad person worse, right? So think about a rapist who's also very resilient. This makes this person a worse criminal.
They're excellent at persevering at exactly what we don't want them to persevere at.
Right, right, yeah. So this makes them a worse person, not a better person. So what we see here is, well, look, resilience is its kind of quality of character that a good person should have, but it needs to be deployed selectively. You need to make sure that you're deploying it in appropriate context. So what we see here is actually resilience is not a virtue, but rather it's a moral amplifier. And if that's not a familiar term to you, I gave a lecture at AtlasCon on this probably 3 years ago, and I did post that as a podcast, and Tammy can post that link in the chat if she hasn't already, and it'll be in the show notes, basically. So take a listen to that, my lecture on moral amplifiers and how they're different from virtues and so on. So basically, resilience is one of these things. So it's not something you want to do all the time or be all the time. It's something you're going to have to be, you want to have it as a character trait, but you're going to have to be careful about when you actually make use of it.
Excellent. And finally, how should resilience be cultivated?
Yeah, so like with most moral amplifiers, resilience seems to be constructed on a kind of base of personality. So in my experience, some people are going to really have to work to develop resilience because they're just not very resilient naturally. And other people are going to have the opposite problem. They're going to have to work to moderate their resilience, or rather to really rein it in, to make sure that they're not being irrationally resilient, because that's going to be their tendency, is going to be just keep persevering, keep going, even when that's not the right.
So they don't have to work on resilience. They have to work on judgment.
Yes.
Yeah.
And if you are somebody who needs to cultivate it, and I do think even the people who are like that, the people who need to work on their judgment, you would still say, look, they need to work on their resilience, because they need to work on being resilient in a rational way. So if you do need to cultivate it, the way to do this is to pursue meaningful but difficult goals. And if you falter and stumble and you become uncertain, actually, I think the ideal thing, to be very Aristotelian about this, is not to just persevere, not to just push yourself, not to just beat yourself up, but have somebody there, have a mentor, a parent, a teacher, a coach, a friend, somebody there who's going to help push you past that, who's going to give you the advice that you need, the encouragement that you need, and the skills that you need to help you succeed. And also the kind of person who can say, look, I can actually see you're really tired. You are not going to succeed today. Let's pick this up tomorrow. And doing that, having that kind of expert in the field who can help you work through this, doing that again and again and again in lots of different areas of your life, yes, you are going to develop resilience.
Yeah, it's invaluable to have that coach, the mentor, the sensei, whoever it is in whatever realm.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they know
they have
better
the judgment.
What
they can tell.
Yeah, they know better what you can do than you do. So, you know, if Martha or Eric, my two coaches here, if they say, like, no, Diana, like, you can do this, then okay, I'm gonna go ahead and try it. And I certainly, like, I did things on the day that I wagged my head. I did a true coffin with Lila. It's a jump to a one stride. then you go over a ditch, and you have one stride, and then you go over another jump. And we had never done anything like that. And granted, we did not do it well. I mean, it was really hard. We had actually a number of refusals to start off with, and I was doing all the wrong thing. But, like, we managed to get over it. I think we got over it twice. Like, all three things all in a row. And, like, that was enough of a success, and we were like, okay, we're going to quit here, and we're going to go work on some other things. And maybe it's the kind of thing that I hope to work on again in a few weeks. But, like, I would not have tackled that thing all by myself. And rightfully so, because I wouldn't have known that I could have done it, and I wouldn't have had the advice that I needed to get through it successfully.
Yeah, they know just the cues to give you to get you through something. And it's also, I've experienced it in enough domains that I have a sort of generalization that has built up in me of how I approach new things, and kind of self-coaching after enough iterations. It's like, okay, there's a feeling that I'm always looking for now, and that's the ideal in any of these skills is to be kind of in this flow where you can be really effective and right at the edge of your ability but not out of control. So the feeling I'm looking for is the feeling of being in the flow but not out of control.
Right.
And so that's one of the things when I was coaching Tammy on downhill on the mountain bike, I could see that she was pushing beyond her ability to control herself. It was like, okay, you see this feeling, the terror you're getting, that tightening that's happening, that's because you're actually out of control. You need to learn to always feel of, even if you succeed in this movement, even if you get over that obstacle or through that tight spot, were you actually in control? If you weren't, you need to dial it down just a little bit to let yourself develop without getting hurt.
Right.
And that's been true across so many domains now that I always look for it. Playing a solo in jazz, doing Aikido on the mat, riding down the mountain on the bike, on and on. There's this snowboarding, that feeling of flow but in control.
Right.
Even if I make it, I chastise myself. It's like, oh, man, that was just luck. I happened to stay on my feet. I was actually being unsafe there. And
right.
It's like, okay, that was wrong.
Yeah, I have a easier feeling of this in skiing than I do in riding, just because I think it's a bit easier to judge. But of trying to keep myself in this like 80 to 95% of where my skills are, so I'm not doing something easy, and it's always a challenge, and I'm always pushing myself. But I don't want to be at 100% because then I'm gonna get, you know, I get to 101% and I'm gonna be a wreck, right?
Well, there's a line from Heinlein, maximal learning occurs at the edge of chaos, I think,
right.
Something like that.
Right.
And so that's what you're trying to do, and that's how you build these kinds of strengths, is by going to the edge of your ability, but not in a reckless way.
Right, right. Yeah. And I will say, this is going to be really important for kids, right? You don't want parents to be coddling their children so that the kids don't know how to do anything by the time they become adults, and they don't have any of this resilience in the pursuit of their goals. But I will say, even if you didn't develop that resilience as a kid, you can do a lot as an adult. And certainly I would say, and I'm interested in your view on this, Greg, I think I've developed way more resilience as an adult by doing things very consciously and deliberately than I ever did as a kid. It's not that I was non-resilient as a kid, but just like I've been able to consciously push myself.
You didn't cultivate
as an adult. Yeah.
That's totally true. Tammy's over here nodding. She did the same thing. She had a small set of skills, and she was very good in those skills. But if she went outside of that domain, oh, man, funny story. We were just saying this the other day. The first time she went mountain biking with me, I was like, okay, this is scary, and you need to stay with the running thing, and maybe we'll just not do the mountain biking together. Because she was so out of control, it was terrifying to me. Like, I could just see from across the way. It's like, no, you need to stop right now. she hadn't been cultivating that. Since then, though, she's been doing it very consciously. It's like, oh, okay, this is cool. I grew up in a household of athletes and adventure. We took it for granted that we would do goofy stuff. We on the block, the kids played kick the can and all sorts of other games that nobody would be allowed to play today. We played on construction sites and did all sorts of things that get us killed. We did take it for granted. I don't know how we made it through youth unscathed. But that said, I also didn't have the kind of mental toughness that I have now at, say, 20. A lot of it is much more internal. Public speaking, being able to be on stage with the music, even the things like the mountain biking and other stuff. There's a mental toughness that I can see has been developed over the last couple decades as an adult, where I just didn't have that. And it's across the board. Learning how to be uncomfortable at CrossFit, knowing what it feels like to be just at that edge of control and having my brain stay settled down. And my lizard brain, at 20, my lizard brain would have melted down at the things that are routine now.
Right.
Being on stage in front of a bunch of cameras and 1,000 people all staring at you in a completely exposed moment, I would have shut down. The same thing with public speaking, like speaking right here in front of just us chickens here. This would have melted me down at 20.
Right.
And on and on. So I think it's a neat thing to point people who haven't done that yet in the right direction.
Yeah, and certainly that's been the case. I mean, for me, like graduate school, that was just one long exercise, 7 years of an exercise in resilience. And no matter what I do, like any intellectual project that I do, like none of it involves as much pressure as finishing, like doing graduate school, writing all my papers, and particularly writing the dissertation did.
Yeah.
Like it's just not, none of it is all, I mean, like I have yet to encounter a situation that's that high pressure. And so like I can compare that and go, well, like, yeah, okay, this is sucking and I'm not wanting to do it. But look, hey, it's not the dissertation. Like keep going, Diana.
Yeah. And there's, these are the things that you can see it in the kids. It's like, okay, they're not used to those kinds of pressures and, or the discomfort, the distress. And they will crumble and say, okay, I'm out. They tap
right.
out very quickly. And it's like,
right.
oh, okay. You need to be able to hang in here. And
right.
The kids just coming out of school, it's like, hey, giving up is not an option. You can't just say, I'm going to tap out of life. That's not an option. So yeah, it's very, very definitely a good thing to build this kind of toughness, this resilience in an appropriate way. This is part of helping the kids bootstrap themselves into being independent adults.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, on that front, hey, what do you think about deliberately imposing hardships on children, like bullying, to cultivate resilience and toughness?
Or like steal, you know, throwing them into a culture where stealing their stuff
yeah.
is normal. Yeah, I think this is horrifying, right? And this is for exactly the reason that the questioner says. Well, look, why not just beat them, right? That'll teach them to be extra resilient, right? Get drunk and you know start
yeah.
throwing cans of soup at them. And there's just, I mean, there's just a difference in degree here, right? There's just a difference in the intent. But honestly, like public school can be a lot more abusive than getting beaten up by your alcoholic
yeah.
Father or mother. So, you know, it might not be all that different.
But I can look back at every bit of the resilience and toughness that I've been able to develop. I don't recall any of it coming from this kind of stuff.
Right.
None.
And that's... None. That's part of the point I want to make here. So I want to make three points here. So first of all, life imposes enough hardships, including on kids, to develop the resilience that's required to live successfully, right? Any sort of extra lot of resilience that you might need, like let's say if you're going to do really intense sports or you're going to be a Navy SEAL or something like that is developed with the training for that activity itself, right? So there's no need for parents to be like, well, maybe you'll be a Navy SEAL, so here I'm going to, you know, do this on you.
We're like,
going to
throw you in an ice bath. For
yeah, like,
yeah,
wait
sure.
wait until you're actually, you know, in the military. They will take care of that. Don't worry. And I would also add on this point, if you think that adult life is like the kind of things that we see in public school, that's because you have been warped by your own public school experience into making that kind of way of life how you live your life now. I mean, the fact is I leave my stuff around all the time without locking it up because I know that the people around me are ordinary and decent and I don't have to worry about it. Like I have yet to lock my vehicle here. Like we go drive off and I don't lock up I don't lock up Helga, my toter home where I'm living. It has all my stuff in it, my computer and so on. There's people at the farm who are not, like, they're with a different group. I don't need to lock up my stuff. And it's thousands and thousands of dollars worth of equipment, just even my saddle sitting out in the barn. I don't need to lock that up. I go to the ski slopes and I go in for a snack and I leave my skis out there because, you know what? It's not Aurora, Colorado, right? I'm going to judge contextually as to what kind of place I'm in and whether it's reasonably safe to leave my stuff out or not.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get to, is that this is really context dependent, and learning to be sensitive to your context is really what you're after here.
Right.
I leave my $3,000 sweet MacBook Pro with Retina display laying around a workplace all day, leave for lunch, I don't sweat that at all. My road bike, depending on where I took it, I might leave it out in front of the Whole Foods for a half hour while I go inside.
Right.
Other times, mountain bike, leaving it at the base of the hill, no, it's going to be locked while I go have the gluten-free beer with someone or something.
Right. Yeah, and this actually brings me to my next point here, which is that if you impose harsh circumstances on a child, and by this I particularly mean irrationality and injustice, which is what, you know, the threat of people stealing your stuff at a moment's notice is, in an attempt to develop resilience and toughness in them, they are far, far more likely to learn very different lessons. Most of them are deeply emotionally damaging, right? The result of that is not resilience. It's hating other people, hating yourself, feeling malicious towards others, distrusting other people, being despondent, feeling hopelessness, feeling terror at other people. Bullying other people is oftentimes a response to being bullied, repressing your feelings and all of these other kinds of things. Like, these are not, like, or at least just cynicism, right? This is what the world is like, is people steal your stuff, which is exactly the attitude in the adult that the questioner saw there.
Yeah,
that is not
projecting it back on the kid now.
Yeah, cynicism is not resilience. That's actually it's a defense mechanism. It's not the same as rational resilience.
Yeah, when we read this question, the attitude that came through to me was that this is like spanking a kid to teach him a lesson. But the positive discipline guys have made this really clear. You're teaching them a different lesson than you think.
Right.
That's not the lesson you're actually after.
Right. Yeah, you're oftentimes teaching them to either be fearful of or sucking up to authority. You're teaching them to be sneaky. You're not teaching them that, you know, XYZ was morally wrong. You don't teach it's like a non sequitur to say, okay, I got spanked for doing X, therefore X is morally wrong. Like, you're not teaching them why, you know, let's say beating up your brother is a bad thing. So third point here. I think the challenge for kids, when we think about raising kids to be resilient, the challenge is that adults are far, far too prone, particularly today, but this is probably true in all times, adults are far too prone to rescue their kids and thereby prevent them from developing the resilience that ordinary life requires.
Yeah. So you don't want to bully them.
That's not what they need. Yeah,
they need
the
to be
solution.
Allowed to skin their knees. That's
right.
That's all.
Right.
How are they going to learn how to be in control if they don't get a little out of control in relatively safe circumstances?
Right.
Let them run beside the pool.
Right.
Then they'll learn not to do that in unsafe ways.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, kids do need to face challenges and difficulties and obstacles in all areas of life, and the job of parents and other adults should be to help them, not in the sense of solving their problems for them, but in the sense of giving them the resources to succeed on their own, right? So providing that mentoring function that you want when you go, you know, start to ride horses or you go mountain biking or something like that. You want somebody there who's going to be a mentor. That's what the parent should be to the child. And so you don't think of your kids as like too small to fail, right? They're just too cute. I can't stand it if they fail, right? If you do that, you're not giving them a chance to grow up and grow into people who can face and overcome obstacles. You need to give them that opportunity to develop persistence and determination and resilience and so on. That's really important. So be sure to allow them that, and think about perhaps what you would want. Think about, if you're a parent, think about, well, here's how I would develop resilience in a new area, and this is what I, the role that I need to play for my kid, therefore.
Yeah. So it's almost as if you have various aspects of your mission as a parent. And there's the protect them from, you know, harm. That's definitely good in the mission. But there's also making it so they can protect themselves when you're not around later on. And it seems like there's too much focus on one to the neglect of the other. And I'm not sure if my parents were that conscious about it, but they I can look back over my life. Very definitely, they were letting us experience challenges at ever greater scopes as we
right.
grew.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So what's the take-home point?
So resilience is not a virtue, but as a moral amplifier, it's a character trait that people should cultivate and deploy selectively. It's properly cultivated by pursuing important and difficult goals of your own choosing. This is very important. Not by having hardships imposed on you.
Indeed. And you don't stop cultivating it. I'm an adult. I'm still busy cultivating it.
Exactly.
It's useful. All right, some follow-up action. Fabian says, I seem to remember reading Ayn Rand saying something rejecting this hardships build character meme, maybe in her letters.
I don't remember that, so
yeah,
I can't speak to that.
And
I expect that she would be all over this. I mean, she would. I would expect, particularly she certainly had a childhood that was filled with hardship, having grown up during the Russian Revolution and so on. And I'm pretty sure that she would say, no, that wasn't actually to my benefit. And that's the thing. Like, look, I just got conked in the head, right? And like, that wasn't actually to my benefit. Right, like there are things that I have learned from that experience, but but getting conked in the head itself was not some kind of like, oh, this is a hardship I need to overcome. Like, let's go get conked in the head again. This is how I'll become a really great rider.
That's
no,
not practice like that. It's the warning that you can ask yourself, was I out of control?
Right.
There's a lesson in there, maybe.
Right.
But no, that's not something to go and do over and over like the kung fu master punching gravel or something.
Right. And just in general, experiences by themselves do not create virtues at all, or any kind of character traits or moral amplifiers. It's the thinking that a person does in response to that and how they decide to act next time, that's what actually really matters. And so if you realize that, you realize, oh, wait, my kid could think about and react in 1,000 different ways to being bullied, most of which, in fact, are going to be really quite horrible for them. So gee, maybe that's not the best way of teaching this. Maybe a sort of a more mentory guided approach where they're actually doing something that they love and they can learn from their success. Like, this seems to be a much better way of teaching.
And from the challenges in it too. It's like, oh, you didn't win the match that you wanted to win against Johnny there. Did you train as hard as you could have? Did you,
right.
you know, or was he just better than you? And is that okay? You know?
Right.
Lots of lessons in there that you can guide them through. Anyway. It's time for a reminder about the tip jar.
Absolutely. Philosophy in Action Radio, not just the live show, but the podcast too, is available to anyone free of charge. That's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide. And we do that with each and every show to thousands of listeners, and our audience grows, but we can't accomplish that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans. So if you value our work, please do contribute to our tip jar. You can visit philosophyinaction.com/support to send money online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. Also, you can create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal, Dwolla, or your bank's bill pay, and then you don't need to remember to contribute, and we really appreciate that regular support. So again, you can do that at philosophyinaction.com/support.
Nuisance limits for new technology. How should nuisance limits be set for new technology? Often new technologies initially involve negative side effects, and sometimes those side effects impact even those who didn't choose to use the new technology. Here's an example. Supersonic flight. Supersonic aircraft are generally noisier than slower aircraft. They lay down a sonic boom when they fly over. In the U.S., supersonic travel has been banned outright since the 1960s due to concerns about boom noise. There's technology to help quiet the aircraft, but no one knows how much quiet and political muscle it will take to reverse this ban. And as a result, we're still trundling around at 1960s speeds. But this is only one example. Many other technologies, such as fossil fuels, initially have some physical impact, even on those who choose not to adopt, until they advance sufficiently that the impact is immaterial. In a free society, how should these technologies be allowed to develop? What restrictions should be placed and how? How does one objectively determine, for instance, how much noise pollution from aircraft or smoke from a train constitutes a rights violation?
So this is a really good question, and the reason I like this question is because you have technology, which you want to be like new and exciting and pushing boundaries, butting heads with the law, which is about being stable and firm and you know, knowing where we are and so on. So it's a nice, it's a nice intersection there.
Now, we have talked about nuisance law before, right?
Yeah, in a very different context, in the context of public nudity, of all things. So, but it's still... It still applies. It's still very relevant. So I'm just going to recap. I'm going to recap the relevant, you know, basic view on my view on nuisance law and what justifies nuisance law. So nuisance is a kind of tort, and a person violates the rights of their neighbors by creating sound, smells, sights, pollution, or other kinds of hazards that prevent neighbors from quietly enjoying their own property. So loud music at 2 a.m, dumping toxic waste into an upstream river, constructing a huge billboard with flashing lights just outside my window. These are not merely unfriendly actions. They are actually a violation of my rights. And the reason is that nuisance properly understood, and this is not always how the law understands it, but this is my interpretation of what the philosophical justification of the law should be. Nuisance properly understood involves physically impinging on your neighbor's property or somebody's property in some unwelcome way. And remember here, the critical thing is that rights are only violated by physical force. So it has to be a physical intrusion into somebody else's property, meaning that the intrusion has to be perceptual, like purely based on your sensory organs. It's not ideas or judgment about the content. So this was obviously quite relevant to the case of public nudity, but it's also relevant to the case of the sonic boom. Like, there is this physical impingement. There is a it's the physical effect, and it's physical, the sound and the effect on your property.
It's the big billboard with the lights, not what's written on the billboard.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So if my neighbor baking bread reminds me of Aunt Judy, who I really hate, like, that's too bad. I just have to suck that up. but if the smell is overpowering such that I can't do anything else with my life, I'm just sitting there and all I'm doing is smelling bread and I can't block it out or any other thing like that, then yeah, that would constitute a nuisance.
Yeah. Okay. So how should law determine whether some new technology constitutes a nuisance or not?
So I think the first rule here is don't panic. So don't say, oh my God, it's a new thing. It's so awful. It's
new
a
bad.
Menace.
New bad.
It's a menace. Ban it now. Right. Yeah. Look,
yeah.
New technology, it's often a huge benefit, and often the technology needs some time to kind of shake out or develop, let's say, you know, mechanisms so that it's less intrusive, and people need time to adjust to it as well. I mean, the fact is that new technology is often less of a nuisance than the old technology. It's less polluting, it's less dangerous, it's less annoying. So think about horses versus cars. We tend to have this view of horse-drawn carriages
thing, yeah.
Based on, let's say, like, if you watch the Pride and Prejudice movies, like, the streets are perfectly clean. But let me tell you, that was not any street in anywhere under horse-drawn carriages. There would have been, you know, 2 feet deep muck and manure because that was actually how much they were polluting. And all the flies and so on that would be living on that.
It's a sewage area, really.
Yes.
And on this front, I was going to say, in the question, they were talking about fossil fuels and the impact. It's like, well, actually, when they first started using fossil fuels, we would look at it from our context and go, wow, that was dirty and horrible. But at the time, they loved it because it was so much cleaner than what they were doing then, like burning dung and wood inside.
Right, exactly.
So much cleaner. And now it's ridiculously dirty to us, but that's okay. That's normal capitalist development there.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so when we're considering whether some new technology poses a nuisance, the law, I think, needs to consider whether the new technology imposes any substantially new burdens on bystanders or nearby property owners. So the question to ask here, is the range of sounds and sights and noises and smells of a sort that we commonly inflict on ourselves and others? Or does it inflict sights and sounds and noises and smells that are genuinely, like, significantly worse in magnitude and duration and frequency and noxiousness or whatnot, so that people are now in some unique way some new way, unable to enjoy their own property or go about their own business. So it's not just novelty. Like, we want to look, is there actually a perceptual difference? Is this noise actually substantially louder than the things that we tolerate generally?
Indeed. So what about sonic booms then?
So the questioner here actually emailed me a bit of follow-up after experiencing some demos of NASA's sonic boom simulators, which I thought was super cool. So here are some facts, and I love facts. They're always useful. Because I've never heard a sonic boom in person, so what do I know what this is?
I remember them when I was really young.
Really?
Before the band hit, I do remember the phenomenon of feeling this big thud and looking up, and you know, things would rattle a little, and it was like, I thought it was kind of cool myself.
Well, that sounds exactly what he describes. He says, quote, "A Concorde-like boom, when heard outside, can be a little startling. It sounds like a pair of gunshots in quick succession. When heard indoors, it's much quieter, more like the sound of a refrigerator door closing. But also your windows, vases, etc. may rattle a little bit, which is a bigger nuisance than the boom itself."
Yep.
Also, there's work happening to try to set noise standards for shaped booms. They're aiming at something really quiet, similar to the sound of highway driving in a luxury car and only a second long. So that's nothing. And then he added the following, because I had said something about, you know, the question is basically whether it's substantially different than other, you know, noises that we do endure. He said the following: "Despite literally billions spent, NASA currently has 100 people on various supersonic projects, including boom noise research. Amazingly, no one has done research comparing the nuisance of sonic booms with other commonplace nuisances, like a neighbor's weed whacker, a Harley-Davidson going by, or a garbage truck," close quote. That's the critical issue here, right? Like, we do, in fact, tolerate all kinds of loud noises, and we tend to tolerate loud noises, let's say, so long as they're not prolonged or repeated really often. Now,
yeah.
Greg, I've heard you complain repeatedly about the noise of your Harleys that are in your neighborhood, and, like, those are super annoying. They're really loud. I mean, when they go by, when they start up and go by, we have to stop talking on our Skype call because for, you know, 10 or 15 seconds because they're just that loud. So I don't know. Tell us a little bit about that.
Ah, see, there was a whole South Park episode about these douchebags. I mean, it's just really, it kills me, and I still don't know how they get away with it. Apparently, the habit is they buy Harleys, which are required by law to have mufflers and so on, and then they modify them to let the engine breathe and be its awesome self. And these are the guys who basically shut down conversation for blocks, and it's on purpose. All the other motorcycles aren't this way. Even big trucks aren't this bad. And somehow they get away with this, even though I'm sure if I set up a speaker putting out that kind of sound on the street, they would immediately come up and shut me down.
Right.
And so there's something going on culturally there, and it's terrible. So, yeah, we glare at them every time they go riding by on their pay attention to me vehicles.
Right. Well, but I mean, at least with those, like, they are moving vehicles. So they're annoying lots of people along the way, but they are not, it's not like you're hearing that all day. It's not like the jackhammer that's right outside your door, which even that we say, look, you have to tolerate it because this construction work has to go on. And like, it's going to be 2 weeks of unpleasantness, but then it'll be over and done with.
Yeah. And we do, that's a necessary kind of evil. And we tolerate that. Or
right.
Yeah. Actually transporting. But it's when they're doing it on purpose. They purposely got a vehicle to do this.
Oh, no, I agree. It's impolite, right? But
yeah, very impolite.
But it's also reasonable, I think, for the law to say, look, in small doses, just people, sorry, folks, you're going to have to suck it up. And I think basically the same should be said for sonic booms, particularly if it's just a few times per day. If it was like once a minute, I could totally see there being like, okay, now wait a minute. You know, this might be a more of a problem for us to have our stuff rattling around.
Always at 3 a.m. and it's like,
right.
Okay.
Right.
No rattling. I could see regulation there where they say you can't rattle people's windows between 10 and 6 a.m., 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. or something like that. They do that for concerts, outside here in Boise.
Exactly.
You stop at 10.
Exactly.
So what if a new technology is a genuine nuisance? What, you know, should it just be banned, or what do you think?
Yeah, so I do think that there's lots of options other than this, and we've already talked about some of them. So one, sometimes the producers of the nuisance might be obliged to take measures to lessen it. So they might be required to put on some kind of muffler. They might limit it to waking hours, Or let's say the nighttime, right? That's another. Sometimes some nuisances would be less nuisanceful, less annoying at night than they would be during the day. You can also limit the frequency. You could limit it to it has to be outside the city or it has to be inside the city. You can also compensate people who are nearby for the nuisance. There's basically lots and lots of options here, other than just ban on all sonic booms or whatever it is. So I mean, I don't have any, like, there's no easy, simple rule for these things. But I think that to say something like, look, is this the kind of thing that we generally tolerate? And if it's something a little bit worse, what can we do to mitigate the problem for people? Like, that's actually a pretty reasonable approach in the law. And I would hope that that's actually what the law would come to with respect to sonic booms, although it doesn't sound like that's the approach that they have right now.
Yeah. All right. So what's the take-home point?
So the law needs to allow for the development of new technology and protect the rights of bystanders and nearby property owners. It can do so by a rational standard for nuisances, where the courts compare the nuisance of the new technology to what's currently accepted and well-tolerated.
All right, a little bit of follow-up. Oh, I was going to say as my own follow-up that NASA spending all this money studying sonic booms but never asking the question, how does this fare relative to what we actually consider just fine? That does seem to be like the kind of policy behind, say, the environmental stuff, where if they determine that something is a poison or harmful at some level, at any level, at some level, then they treat it as if it's damaging at every level. And so the goal is zero. And
right.
So here they've just assumed zero. Zero is what's required.
Right. Yeah, and this is not – this, like – no private industry, one would hope, would argue in this fashion. Right?
No.
yeah, this is government. You're government at work, right? Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so KPOM asks, how do you differentiate nuisance versus NIMBYism? Everyone wants great cell phone service, but no one wants the tower next door.
That's actually a sort of separate question. I would encourage you to submit that into the chat. I mean, into the main queue. The question is, like, look, there are some things that you might not want nearby, and reasonably so, and I think the law has to say, okay, well, is this a genuine nuisance? And if so, like, you know, can we compensate you? Can we, you know, how can we mitigate it and so on? I do think there is a lot of I want things to, people have this a kind of conservative attitude in a way, and I don't mean politically conservative, but just in a, I would prefer things to stay how they are. Thank you very much. And I can understand that, because at least the status quo is acceptable to them.
Yeah,
and
they,
certainly,
you know what it is.
Yeah, having a, you know, let's say a big power plant built right next to you might not be something that you're going to like, and it might really affect your property values and so on. And so I understand people being very concerned about change, but I also think people need to be a bit more rational. I've certainly seen with my neighbors, with the prospect of this dam being built and a reservoir being put in next to our neighborhood, just this, like, on the one hand, I think there's legitimate concerns with that going in there. And I also see a lot of, like, just rabid emotionalism. Oh my God, I don't care how safe it actually is. I would just be so fearful that it would burst and we would all die. And that would be that. And so
yeah.
Like, dude, that's not acceptable.
So, yeah. For the specific example here, you can see kind of how it would roll out with other things too, but the cell phone service. Yeah, everybody does want that. Nobody wants an unsightly tower right next to their house, but it is pretty normal for somebody to come into an area and pitch it to the people there and say, hey, would you tolerate this? And if they say, heck no, they would, okay, what if we decorated it in this way and made it look like a tree? And
right.
What if we paid you yay much? What if you got free cell phone service for life? You know, whatever it takes to compensate you until the people in that area are like, no, this is fine.
I would totally take an unsightly cell tower on our property in order to get actual cell service at our place. Like, that would actually be a real benefit.
I want good connectivity, thank you.
Yeah.
And this is true of dumps. There are a lot of places where it's like, you don't want the dump right in the middle of your city. But there are people a little bit further out in more rural areas who are like, oh, you want to compensate us for that? Yeah, sure, put it right over there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
More than happy to. That's
exactly.
That whole actual P peaceful trade thing.
Yep, it really does work.
Yeah. Oh, respecting rights, what do you know? It's a good thing. Okay, hey, why don't you remind listeners about your book, Responsibility and Luck?
So this is my first book, hopefully soon to be really my first, and that the second should be coming out soon. Responsibility and Luck, A Defense of Praise and Blame. It is available for purchase in paperback and Kindle formats. The book defends the justice of moral praise and blame of persons using an Aristotelian theory of moral responsibility, thereby refuting Thomas Nagel's problem of moral luck. It's an academic work, but it's accessible to anyone with an interest in philosophy. And for details, including free preview chapters and podcasts, chapter-by-chapter podcast, you can visit philosophyinaction.com/moral luck. Now, on the podcast series, I think I've done chapter 6, and so I'm waiting. Chapter 7 is upcoming. So we'll see. I don't think I'll actually do any of those while I'm in Aiken, particularly since I just knocked my noggin. I'm not eager to give myself a bunch of new work. But that those should
might
resume
want to just take it easy for a couple days.
I know. Those should resume in late March or early April.
Okay, moving on. Spouses sharing activities. Should spouses always share activities? A friend of mine is loath to pursue any hobbies or interests that her husband doesn't share. He's not controlling. She's the same way. Although I know they want to spend time together, that seems really limiting to me. Is that a reasonable policy in a marriage, or does it lead to self-sacrifice and mutual resentment?
Oh, my gosh. Like, so my reaction to this is like, for the love of God, get your own life, people.
Yeah. Well, you're at one end of the spectrum, maybe.
I don't know. Yeah. No, I think there's a reasonable range here. But look, marriage should not be a straitjacket where your activities are limited due to the interests of your spouse. I mean, look, sharing activities is fabulous. But if you're not both interested, it's important and it's really healthy to do things alone. And Greg, you and Tammy, so I think that like Paul and I are sort of on one end of the spectrum and you and Tammy are perhaps on the other end of the reasonable side. So tell us about you and Tammy, because you guys do a lot together.
Yeah, it's actually crazy. And I think this is done in a healthy way like you're talking about, though. It wasn't by design. It was more just lucking out. It's like, well, look at this. We ended up with so much overlap. So we do CrossFit. That's a big chunk of time. We ride the mountain bikes. But there are still differences. I go and play jazz sax for blocks of time at gigs. She's heard me play enough, and she really treasures her time alone. She likes running crazy marathons and ultra-marathons. Me? No way. And so it's like, yeah, you have fun. I'll cheer you on and be drinking beer or whatever until you get to the finish line.
Yeah.
And there was a little bit of help along the way. Like I was doing Aikido for about a half a decade, and that was a significant chunk of time throughout the week, but that's something you can pull off as a single dude. When I started hanging out with her, I dropped that because it just wasn't compatible with having a mate. And after that, we added CrossFit, which was a similar size block of time, but we're doing it together. So
right.
That was fun bonding time.
Right.
So we're definitely at one end of the spectrum.
Yeah, and Paul and I tend to do a lot of parallel play, and we do a lot of things independently. So obviously my riding is not something that he shares, or he's totally not interested in doing, and I actually think it would be very unsafe for him to do.
Is that me with Tammy in the mountain biking? He's like, hey, no, not for you.
He just, Paul, I love my husband dearly, but he does not have speedy reaction times in the, like, okay, crisis, let me, like, I will get myself organized and I will do the right thing.
Cat-like reflexes.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and it's not, and it's, I don't know, it's also, like, I grew up doing dangerous things all the time. So, like, when I need to change a light bulb in the office, I go get on the Herman Miller, like, the wiggly office chair, and I stand up there and I change the light bulb. He wouldn't dare do that, right?
Yeah, when I do things like that.
And I don't know that he could. I think he would. He might fall down and hurt himself. So.
Yeah. Whenever I'm climbing on some ladder or standing on the precariously on the chair or whatever, Tammy's hiding her eyes and going, no, don't, please don't, because she knows she would die if she did that.
Yeah. Anyway, so I don't want Paul to ride. I actually don't think that would be good for him. But he does. He helps out in the barn. He attends competitions when he's free. He's home taking care of all the other beasts while I'm in Aiken. So, like, you know, that's all the support I could possibly ask for. And then he's definitely got the science geeky medicine side that I don't share. And so he has, you know, like lots of discussions with people online or like when we go to Atlanta and he gets to talk to Aaron Bilger and he's like super excited about that. And I'm like, go, like, don't, I'm going to go talk over here with some other people. You go off and talk geek.
Don't hurry back.
Yeah. And we do, like, he's obviously, he writes a lot of his columns, involved in that, but I give him space to do those. And I also, we chat about them. So he'll, you know, tell me, here's what I'm thinking about, and I'll say, here's how I think you should write this op-ed, which sometimes might be useful to him and sometimes might not be. Or I'll be doing something and I'll be making dinner and he'll be like, hey, can I read you my op-ed? And I'll, you know, give him feedback as we go. So we have a lot of discussions of our common interests and so on, and a lot of kind of parallel play, but we're not out there like doing the same physical activities. And even actually, so I ski and he doesn't, because that's another thing that he would be dangerous for him to even attempt. I think he did, and it was not good. But he snowshoes, so we will go up to the mountains together, and he snowshoes and I go skiing, and then we come back and like, hey, like we have our dinner together and we get to tell each other what happened, and that like that works out really really well. Both of us are doing what we most want to do.
And we've talked about this in the past where it is important for spouses to at least appreciate why their mate wants to do X and to support it,
right.
But you don't need to do it at the same time.
Right. Yeah, and I would have two basic rules here. So, one, if you love doing the same things, and I think if you're married, you should sometimes like doing the same things, right? Go ahead and do them together when you can. Because otherwise, you're just roommates, and why are you married? Right? So, yeah, you should have some shared interests and shared activities and be doing those together. But the second rule is, if you love doing different things, then do them separately and be happy for yourself and supportive of your spouse. Because otherwise, I think you're in this codependent relationship rather than a relationship of independent equals. And so that's really dangerous. I mean, it shouldn't be the case that marriage is a sacrifice for either person. And certainly neither person should sacrifice to spend time together. And, I mean, think about that. Like, think about it. You're like, okay, I would really like to go, you know, I'd really like to go ride my horses. But instead of doing that, I'm going to go to the science museum with Paul. Not that he would actually be interested in that, but just for an example. I'm going to go to the science museum with Paul so that we can spend time together. But meanwhile, I'm bored and miserable. And, like, how is that good for our marriage? Wouldn't it be better for him to go to the science museum, maybe with a friend, and I'll go riding, maybe with one of my riding friends, and we'll come back together and we'll have, like, a really fabulous dinner and be able to both be really happy and tell each other, oh, here's what I did with my day?
Like, that's probably better. And who would want their spouse to be bored and miserable?
Yeah.
That.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I think it's really important here to never, ever burden your spouse with the following. I really want to do X. But I won't do it unless you do it with me.
Oh,
like, that's so manipulative.
Manipulative.
So, trying to induce guilt. Like it's selfish in this really petty sense of the term, which I wish there was another word to describe.
Short-sighted, abusive way, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, be supportive of what your spouse loves to do, even if it's not interesting to you, and then be willing to go and do things on your own or with your own friends. That's important. That's so much better than trying to wrangle and guilt an unwilling spouse into doing something with you.
And that's where the questioner gets it exactly right. That would lead to self-sacrifice and resentment.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's really, and I think the psychological studies support me here. It is good for a marriage for people to have, for the two spouses to have independent lives and independent interests and independent friends. You're not marrying a carbon copy of yourself, right? And if your spouse doesn't want that, I think that's a red flag. That's a problem to fix. And even if the spouse isn't overtly controlling people or one person can be subtly manipulative so that people are unhappy in the long run and they'll get divorced, you know, 15 years later and go like, why did I do that? Why did I give up these, you know, these hobbies that actually meant so much to me just because like I didn't want to, you know, I wanted to please my spouse and he didn't want to have me away from him for so long. Like, dude, that's not right. You will look back upon your life and be unhappy with that. So don't accept that now. Go out and do what you find to be most interesting and fulfilling and come back to your spouse and go, oh, look, I did this great thing here. Let me tell you about it. And everybody will be happy. Hopefully.
Nice. Okay, what's the take-home point?
So people in happy marriages should pursue activities together sometimes, but not always. Each person should freely pursue his or her own interests independent of his or her spouse.
Excellent. Let's see. Not seeing much in the way of follow-up. So how can people interested in your work keep up with you?
So you can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/philosophyinaction. You can subscribe to our weekly newsletter with announcements of upcoming shows, past podcasts, and a preview tidbit over at philosophyinaction.com/newsletter. And you can subscribe to our podcast feed via iTunes, and all of our RSS feeds are over at philosophyinaction.com/RSS.
Okay, it's rapid-fire time where we put Diana on the hot seat. I'll ask questions from this long and growing rapid-fire queue in any old order I feel like, because I'm the decider. And interesting things can happen because Diana hasn't gotten to prepare. So not a lot of time here, maybe one or two.
Sure.
Oh, right up front here. This is great. In England, it will soon become illegal for parents to smoke in the car when their children are with them. What's your take on this?
I know as a kid, I hated it when not my parents didn't smoke, but other people's parents smoked in the car. And I mean, even just on a short ride up the private road, which multiple houses were on, and I'd have the windows down, but nonetheless, like, it was just gross. So, hey, I can understand kids protesting this, right, and not finding this delightful. But the question is, does this actually do the kids serious harm? And my understanding is that the studies on secondary smoke don't show substantial harm from secondary smoke. Now, if I'm wrong about that, then, yeah, it would be like slowly poisoning your kids, and you shouldn't be able to, let's say, smoke in a car with the windows up with them. But it's also just, it's such nanny statism, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, how about a public education campaign from some nice, not government-funded nonprofit about this? You know?
Yeah. So, it's not a rights violation. As you were saying, the science does not seem to point to it actually being truly harmful, except in, like, rare cases where someone has some funky asthma or something like that.
Right.
That the concentrations of smoke that you get as a secondhand smoker are thousands of times less concentrated than when they're taking it straight through their filter or whatever.
Right.
And so for me, and I'm much like you, maybe worse, I am super sensitive to smoke. It is one of the biggest irritants to me. I've been disgusted by it my whole life. I had a smoking parent. I suffered through a lot of that, even as a sax player going to the gig over, 45-minute drive away. I'm in the van with this guy who needs to chain smoke all the way there, and I'm dying the whole way.
Yeah.
And then I go work in the smoke-filled bar that starts out tolerable almost, and it ends with you walking out after 4 hours stinking of this nasty stuff. So for me, anytime I'm around smoke now, it's just like, wow, that's the most disgusting habit, and it's incredibly impolite, like the Harley guys, for you to do that to people around you. It is noxious, but I still don't think that it should be outlawed.
Right.
I just think it's super impolite, and we should shun people that do that to each other.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, final one here. Should someone be condemned if they have no moral problem with homosexuality, but nevertheless find it disgusting?
You know, I think it depends on the way that this is expressed. I mean, look, there's all kinds of sexual practices that, for me, I'm like, wow, you know what? Totally not interested in that. And I'm slightly put off. Like, oh, wow, that makes me a bit nauseous to even think about that. Right? And, like, that's, but I wouldn't morally condemn somebody who is interested in that. And I don't make it a big point to be like, are you this kind, right? I mean, so there's no expression of disapproval. But the question is, for me, I guess, would say, is there a problem? So this is my, I just thought about this, so we'll see whether this thought pans out or not. Is it the case that you are opposed to sexual practices that are commonly performed by homosexuals, particularly like gay men? Like, is your problem with anal sex? And in which case, do you find it disgusting when straight couples do that, which large, large percentages of straight couples have engaged in anal sex at some point? is that what you find disgusting, or is it like two men being together? Because if it's one, it's one thing to say, look, I find this particular sexual practice like ew, right? And I can understand that. I might not agree with it, but I can understand that. But if you find it disgusting that two men are together, then I think that that is a there's something more substantive there. There's something about homosexuality there that I think is, even if you're not overtly condemning your, you know, gay male couples that you know, you're likely to be transmitting that disapproval to them in some fashion. And yeah, there is likely a moral disapproval underneath of that in some way. There's your, you know, you regard the two men being together as unnatural in some way, et cetera, even apart from their sexual practices. So
interesting. I was heading in a little different direction. I was thinking, as you were saying, before you got on that part, I was like, well, I have no moral problem with people eating fish, but nevertheless, I find the idea of eating fish disgusting.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, I have no moral problem with, well, I don't know if that's true. I don't generally have a moral problem with the idea of S&M because it's like, well, okay, you guys, whatever floats your boat. Absolutely not interesting to me, though.
Right.
Hmm.
Yeah. I'm incredibly bored by it, actually. But the question is like is it actually the act themselves that is like, oh yeah, you know, that's I wouldn't want to do that. That's one thing, right? Versus two men being together being disgusting, like that. That's a different feeling, and I think that is a kind of moral emotion, and that's a judgment of the relationship itself, which I think that that's something that you should investigate and do some introspection on and try to figure out why that would be the case. And, like, maybe get to know some gay couples and I mean, like, not make an effort in this, but like, you know, I mean, like you don't want to...
Here's my new gay friend. Yeah.
I know, yeah, not like that, but just... Take the time to, you know, like, hang out with some people who happen to be gay and get to know them a little bit as people. And the result of that is seeing, like, oh, yeah, their relationships are, like, I mean, whatever they're doing in the bedroom is their own business, right? But how they interact with each other out socially and company and so on, like, it's all the same as all my straight friends. So,
and maybe
big
it's
deal.
Just not, you know, lack of familiarity because you're used to heterosexual couples around you. There's
right.
lots of them giving each other pecks
right.
on the cheek and little PDAs. You still don't probably, in most cases, want to observe them doing their stuff on their own.
Right.
It's like,
right.
No.
I will say, I think there is a very interesting reason why a lot of men are really adamantly disgusted by and opposed to male homosexuality. So here's my theory on this, which I think is, which I'm 95% certain is correct for a good number of bigoted men, which is that it's scary to them that they might be the object of somebody else's sexual desire, somebody else who could force themselves on them in the way that they treat and could force themselves on a woman.
Oh, that's an interesting angle.
The idea, like, suddenly they are the prey. They are the sexual prey. And they know how they think about women. And they know how they could overpower a woman if they wanted to. And the thought of them being – so they're fine with being a predator. The thought of them being prey and knowing that somebody else could have their way with them against their will freaking terrifies them.
Wow.
And so that is their problem. It's a kind of – like, it's – oddly, it's not the real problem. Like, the surface problem is homophobia. The deeper problem is sexism.
Or being a predator, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, having that predatory relationship to women.
That's interesting.
And which is why they don't care about lesbians. Like, oh, dude, lesbians are hot, man, right?
Heck yeah.
Like, they only care about about male homosexuality, and that is what is appalling and disturbing to them.
So
and,
it's not homosexuality per se. It's
right,
male
right.
male homosexuality.
It's male homosexuality.
That's
an
intriguing hypothesis there.
Yeah, they are not – they are terrified at the prospect of being a target. And it's funny because it's the men who tend to have that view are men who tend to pursue women in this predatory kind of way.
That is interesting. So I guess I'm proud to say that I don't have any trace of that in my mind, so I can't say that would be it.
Right.
Because I guess I've never approached romantic relationships that way.
No, I can't imagine you doing that.
No.
Actually.
No.
But I think that's.
I still think lesbians are hot. So.
Yeah. No, that's all right.
That's normal.
Are hot. But I just I can't I think that's one of the reasons why some people have this like seemingly like out of the blue crazy pathological fear of gay men. Like the thought of like them being hit on is like they're going to respond with violence to that, and it's because they're scared out of their wits.
That is a really interesting idea. I want to see if somebody can gather some data on that.
Huh. Yeah. I don't know where I came up with that or how. I mean, I don't think I've read that somewhere, but it's a theory I've had actually for quite a long time. I'm curious if my gay friends think that this matches their experience in some way. I'd be curious about that.
Okay, we're way over time now.
We're way over
scrolling
time.
Scrolling down. Oh, there it is. Okay, it's time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. Thanks for listening. We hope you all had a great time.
So I had a fantastic time. Once again, thank you to our generous contributors. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you ideas that engage the mind and help you live better. Plus, we introduce thousands of other listeners to the principles they need to live virtuous, happy, and free lives. We think that's hugely important, and we do depend on your support. So if you want to contribute, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support.
And remember, we welcome feedback on what we're doing well as what we could do better, too. Just email feedback to diana@philosophyinaction.com.
Also, if you want to see what's on tap for the next few weeks, visit philosophyinaction.com/upcoming.
I'm Greg Perkins, and you can find me online at objectivismseminar.com. This show features Dr. Diana Shea. You can read her blog, Noodle Food, at philosophyinaction.com/blog. Please drop by to submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows, and then join us live here at the same time next week at philosophyinaction.com.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.